Welcome to Not Work, Myth, and Storytelling. This is the show where ancestral wisdom meets the modern imagination. I'm your host and lead storyteller, Marisa Gowdy. I'm a myth worker, a story healer, and a writing coach. I'm the author of The Sovereignty Knot, A Woman's Way to Freedom, Power, Love, and Magic, and the founder of the Writer's Knot and Author's Knot communities. On Knot Work, we explore the mythology and folklore of Ireland and beyond. Whether you're drawn to Celtic culture and the power of the landscape, or whether you just like a good story and expansive conversation, you're in the right place. Fáilte. If you love what you hear and want to support the show, I'd be so grateful if you'd become a paid subscriber to my Myth is Medicine newsletter over on Substack. Look for the link at the top of the show notes or visit mythismedicine.substack.com. Season 6, Episode 26, Lunasa, Harvest, Celebration, Sacrifice. This week, a story from the archives. It's a story that I actually told this time last year. And at first I hesitated. You know, it seems like I just told it. But here's the thing, I'd forgotten all about it. I think so many of us who are in this world of content creation, or so the modern phrase goes, though another way to put it, a more noble and beautiful way to put it, is those of us who create art for an audience on the regular, worry about how we'll be received if we dare to do something again. But that's what these stories that mark the Celtic wheel in particular are for. Stories from across cultures that appear at certain times, depending on what is blossoming on the vine, depending on what fish are running in the river, depending on the snowmelt and the first harvest. Because this is, in fact, a harvest story. It's a story for Lunasa, that Celtic holiday, that Celtic festival that comes round at the very start of August. It's the story of Teltu, of the Firbolg, and her foster son, Lu, that many-skilled god of the Tuatha De Danann, who lent his name to the festival itself. Though we have many more weeks before we actually greet a new season when the equinox comes, in many ways, this story at Lunasa Tide was told to mark a new season. And in the spirit of that, I want to ask you about your next creative season. How will you show up and shape the next season of creativity for yourself? I wanted to let you know that the Writer's Knot is currently welcoming new members. This is the global writing community where the mythic imagination meets creative expression. We gather together each week to write together, talk together, grow together. I offer a new set of carefully crafted writing prompts for each session. And in this upcoming season, which runs from September to the very start of January, we'll be exploring the archetypal power of the landscape. So much more than mere setting, the land shapes the imagination, culture, and relationships. It holds the stories of the ancestors and the memories of your own life. If this story of Teltu inspires you, she herself a goddess who shapes the land with her own fierce devotion, then there's a great chance that you'll love being in the company of other myth-minded writers and creatives. Some members of the Writer's Knot are lifelong writers who are seeking a place to focus and seeking a new sense of community. Others are picking up a pen for the first time in as long as they can remember and are seeking a space to test the waters and get to know their own inner world. This group is a place of deep welcome and acceptance. As one current member says, I love the Writer's Knot because everyone there is unguarded but not unboundaried. It's a place to meet yourself on the page and bear gentle witness to writers from around the world who are building the courage to do the same. This September, we're forming two different cohorts of the Writer's Knot. One meets at noon on Wednesdays, that's Eastern time, and the other will meet Fridays at 3:00 Eastern. You can find all the details at marisagowdy.com or just check the link in the show notes. We'll be getting started on September 3rd, and I would love to have you with us. And now it's time to tell you a story. Taltu wasn't particularly heartbroken when Yoki, son of Eric, was killed. The violent slaughter of her people was devastating. But she wasn't necessarily sad to watch the old regime fall to make room for the new. She had been queen of the Ferbulug, but to be first amongst women in a race named for the men of the Bulug wasn't really saying much. The Ferbulug had recently returned to this island after a long time away. They were hardened by their years of exile and labor. They'd toiled in the hot weather of the south, enslaved to a people who thought them capable of little more than moving earth and toting clay. They had managed to turn barren rock into fertile fields, but their own labors never benefited their own tribe. Even when they were freed from their chains and made their way back to the land that we now know as Ireland, life was struggle and toil. They had lost the magic of music and poetry after all those years in the unrelenting Grecian sun. And so, Taltu was queen, but she was too busy being of service to worry about the royal tea service. For the Ferbulug, marriage was for children, and children were for labor, and labor was for survival, and survival was all they understood. Taltu prided herself on knowing better than speaking of foolish things like love or desire. She would never let on that she knew there was more to this life than the next meal. Once upon a time, when she was younger and bolder and less weathered by time and dismissal, she had tried to speak to her people of such things, but she had long since given up. Until the dream. She couldn't keep the dream of 1,000 black birds filling the sky to herself. She awoke with a terrible, stony certainty in her belly. A new fleet of warriors was speeding toward their shores. Her husband Yoki dismissed her, as she had expected. He returned to the endless quarrels with his men about the lack of fish in the river and what the latest hunting expedition had produced. Taltu nursed her terror in silence as she joined the rest of the women, harvesting roots and gathering mushrooms and acorns from the great oak grove. And then they all smelled the smoke. The horde of marauding heroes arrived in great clouds of white and gray and black. It seemed as if they blew in on magic mists, but it was only that the new arrivals had burned their boats when they landed upon the shore. These were the Tua de Danann, the people of the goddess Danu, and they were utterly certain they would not need those boats again. They were here to conquer and bring their new breed of magic to this land cradled in the northern seas. The Ferbulug put up a mighty resistance, but nearly all died upon that battlefield. Taltu and her women were safe. They hid in the mighty oak groves, nestled beneath the moss that blanketed the fallen trees that still served the sacred purpose in this mighty forest. In the negotiations following the 4-day battle, the Ferbulug were given the land of Connacht, the western province with its gorgeous, lonesome shores. Over time, as the Tua de grew more established on this land, weaving their songs into the streams and letting the soft light of a spring morning shape their bardic dreams, a peace grew between them and those they'd pushed to the distant west. The Tua de were a confident lot, but they wanted to do all that they could to make certain they would ever reign over these forests and mountains and rivers. They sent their best and brightest, a deeply talented boy named Lu, to foster with the Ferbulug people. Taltu, ever attentive, ever steadfast, ever kind, was the clear choice to serve as the boy's foster mother. Their bond was a powerful one and promised to last through this lifetime and beyond. When Lu was grown and left his fosterage in Connacht to enter full-time hero work with the family of his birth, Taltu was bereft. He'd promised to return, and she trusted that he would when he could, but it was cold comfort on her clouded days. She'd grown accustomed to that beautiful, brash, young male energy beside her hearth. This was a young man who could teach her about his goddess Danu, and who helped her remember the beautiful, brash young girl she had tried to be once upon a time. He respected her, his foster mother, as a woman and as a mother in a way that was utterly unknown in her clan. Through this boy, who she had not birthed with her body, she was born anew. Grateful did not begin to describe how she felt. A new sense of power had awoken within her. But these huddled villages, the last of the Forbolag, these people were not interested in her new ideas, her new songs, or her new bright expression. And so, after she had spent too many lonely nights wondering what her bright, shining boy was doing in the world, she decided to find him. She headed eastward to the heart of Ireland and then beyond. She made her way through endless forests until she reached a gentle river that reflected the sun and the sky. She wanted to see more sky in this place. She had a vision. Since she could not find Lou, perhaps he could find her. Alone in the dense wood, sustained only by river water, as she gave herself no time to forage for food, Taltu set to work. She had always found it strange that her people had been so very skilled at creating fertile soil when they had been enslaved by the Greeks, but only remembered the relentless toil when they returned to their homeland. Had they not been paying attention to what their captors did with that land once it was reclaimed from the bare granite and cloaked in rich clay? They planted crops. They set seeds in the soil and practiced patience as the sprouts reached towards the sun and became wheat and barley. But the Forbolag were too busy nursing their resentments and using bones to pick meat from their teeth to notice. But Taltu, she paid attention. She understood this miracle of agriculture. To fill a field with potential life, offer it enough care and time, and harvest it before the cold and the dark set in, and then trust the bellies of the people could be full all winter? Miraculous. Or so it seemed. Taltu was an innovator. Rather than naked stone, she had a profusion of wooded life before her. Fortunately, she knew that it was a woman's birthright, not just to create and grow, but also to destroy and release. She would strip away these trees and brambles and reveal the waiting earth beneath. She would bring new life and a new way of being through this act of conscious destruction. And so, she got to work, day and night, only sleeping when she stumbled and could not stand. She had no tools but her own hands, her devotion to her golden boy, and her desire to offer the new people of this land and their goddess an enduring way to show her gratitude. After a full season of labor, great clear plains flanked the sides of this meandering dark river. She was pleased, but she was depleted, and beyond depleted. She lay down for a rest. This time she would allow herself more sleep, real sleep. But she never rose again. In the meantime, Lou had heard of the mighty woman who single-handedly transformed the forest beside the meandering Blackwater River. He wanted to know who such a being might be, and he set out as soon as his heroic schedule would allow. On the riverbank, he saw a crumpled form. By the long hair and the slim ankles, he knew she was female, but she was so very small. Only when he stretched his own radiant hand to touch her shoulder and turn her toward him did Lou realize it was his own beloved Taltu. She had been a holy mountain to him in life. How did she have such a narrow face, such fragile wrists, such slim hips? He wept and cried out, and his voice was swallowed by the vast new expanses that surrounded him. Now Lou was as wise as the mother he mourned, and he understood what Taltu had been imagining when she set herself to this impossible task. He knew she had sacrificed herself so that his people and all of the people of this land could find a new way of living on and with the earth herself. And he cursed Taltu's selfless, delusional dedication, even as he marveled at Taltu's love and power. How could she believe that these green fields were more important than she was, there by her hearth, all full of curiosity and love? But calculating the cost after all had been given and all had changed utterly, was the preoccupation of a fool. He looked up from her lifeless body, and a vision of his own came to him. It was too late in the summer to plant new crops, but this would be the perfect place for a great gathering. And so he called all of the Tuatha Dé and all of those who were brave enough amongst the Fir-Bulug to come for a great festival, games and feasting, all in honor of the remarkable woman who had fostered him and who left her mark forever upon their land and culture. A great barrow was created not far from that bend in the river where Lu had found Taltu. The Fir-Bulug who attended still remembered how to move earth to create a burial mound that would last millennia. And so, Taltu was remembered and mourned and celebrated that day, as she would have been by every person who had learned to sow seeds and harvest crops and take the title of farmer. Shanae. That's my story for today. The one that I concocted back in the summer of 2024. I'm still sitting with what it said to me last year, and I'm really intrigued by what it's saying to me now. As I said at the top, I really had forgotten I had written it. It seemed like years ago, and I think that's part of the creative condition for so many of us. And yet, as I come back to it, it's so clear that this story had and still has so much to teach me about work and overwork and all the ways we can get so caught up in what we convince ourselves must be done, regardless of the cost. Think back to the story. Did Taltu have to clear the fields? Did she have to do it alone? Could she have paced herself, nourished herself, allowed the job to take the whole of the summer and maybe more? Could she have been able to trust that Lu would have found her if she would just wait for him? But the force of her mother's love, the vastness of her grief as she was left with that empty nest, it left no time for patience. And of course, she must have inherited some sort of deep get-it-done gene from her Fir-Bulug ancestors, who knew nothing but toil and never would have had the chance to rest or pace themselves. They were enslaved, after all. It wasn't patience and self-care that got them free of the Greeks. It was work and ingenuity and certainly a great deal of pain. They even used the sacks that they'd been forced to use to haul earth and clay to build coracles and canoes that they would use to sail from the Mediterranean all the way to Ireland. Now, what informs my second hearing of my own story is a year of living, of course, but it's also my recent in-depth experience with the Bard Mythologies Summer School. I'll be telling you more and more about that experience, I know, as this season comes to a close and a new one begins, and I'm so excited to introduce you to many new storytellers from their community. But as part of the Bard Mythologies Summer School, we spent time really looking deep at the Lóra Gabhála Éireann, the Book of Invasions. That's a key source for this particular story. And every time you have an opportunity to revisit a text, or even more importantly, to sit with a group and talk about all the resonances and different interpretations, just simply the people in any given circle could have about a story, your perspective grows. And so, as I look back at my own retelling, I see the way that feminism and a love of the divine feminine that I really rooted into the hearts of the Tuatha Dé was in deep contrast to what I named as a deeply limited Fir-Bulug people. The version that I offered you last year was sourced in the work of friends and not work contributors like Jen Murphy and Ali Isaac, both of whom you would have heard in past episodes telling their own stories. And I wove my own interpretations of the original source materials with theirs. And I really was staying within the lines of the tradition, even as I imagined the bits that the bare bones manuscripts didn't provide. But again, as the Bard is offering me even more insight into mythologies, they've been at this work for 30 years and more, after all, I found my way over to their website and was reminded and surprised by what I had seen there, because these ideas didn't necessarily show up in my own telling. This is from the Bard site. I'll include the link in the notes. No lakes burst forth when they landed, and they cleared no new plains. Nor had they to fight against the Fomorians, the people who were here before them, for dominion over Ireland. They did decide to divide Ireland between these five chieftains, all of them of the Firbolg, named previously in the passage here. And that was the first division of the provinces we still know today. So that's very cool. They were really thinking in terms of leadership and geography and the process of naming. But here's something that's even more striking. The Firbolg named the southernmost province Munster, and it became the land of poetry and music. Leinster in the east was the land of prosperity, while Connacht in the west was the land of wisdom. And then the north, the stony soil of Ulster, bred strong men and women and became the land of warfare and strife. In the center, Meath was the province of the High King, which unified all the others with the seat of the kings at Tara and the seat of the Druids at Uisnech. The Firbolg ruled Ireland for 37 years and had 9 kings in all that time. Now, when I write this story anew at some point when I feel called to, I think I'm going to have to think about the way that these Firbolg people, who I sort of sold short as a bunch of, well, were they ignorant in my telling? Were they just disinterested in the niceties of things like poetry and the creation of a rather sophisticated government? I just had them being a bunch of guys loading bags who were out for a bid for survival. When I wove this story, I was thinking about the heroine. I was thinking about her specific needs in terms of the narrative. At that point, it didn't capture my imagination and my interest. The way that the Firbolg were a people driven off their land by other invaders, the Nemedians. The way that they'd been enslaved for 200 years. The way they traveled thousands of miles by sea in boats made of those same bags that gave them their name. Now, when I look back at this story, I'm thinking a bit more about the way we may tell stories and look to anyone, any other group who are named as other. Those whose experience has been too hard, too foreign, too rigid, according to the standards that we ourselves hold dear. The others that we tend to flatten in order to make our own chosen ones more three-dimensional. Now that I've seen that in my own narrative, I feel the urge to pull it down, rewrite it, give myself a hard time for my own lack of curiosity. How dare I focus so much on Teltu when I wasn't even thinking about her own long-term traumatized people? But then, I can remember what I've learned in my years of myth working. The way that I know that these stories reveal their aspects to us when their moment is right. When we, as individuals, have eyes to see specific details, and most importantly, the hearts to receive them. Last year, when I developed the version of this story you just heard, I was focused on the ways we work and overwork. I was particularly interested in the ways that mothers and women and all people who live fully into the verb that is mother tend toward self-sacrifice. I chose details that helped me tell that particular tale. And now, for a multitude of reasons, one of those being the amount of healing and reflection that I did simply by working with this story so closely, I can now see new perspectives. It's much like the whole onion thing, right? You work with a myth at one layer of personal preoccupation or collective big picture concern, and then later you come back ready to find yourself engaging with another layer and wondering how you never saw it before. Last time I told the story of Teltu and Lou, I was thinking about gender roles. In the commentary that followed, I dove deep into the cost of settled agriculture and what might have happened to the entire history of the world if we hadn't accepted that the accumulation and cultivation of land was the only way forward. I still think that's an interesting question, but what I see now when I look to this story are the ICE raids across the U.S. and the way we see immigrants to this land being targeted and persecuted, othered in every sense of the word, from harassment to imprisonment to deportation. I'm aware of how I might have taken an entire race of people and flattened their story to add cause and stakes to the tale of a singular heroine. It's something we do in fiction all the time. In fact, we know that fiction tends to work not when we try to write about great big masses of people, but when we really allow our readers and listeners to focus in on the emotions they feel about one or two or any very small group of beings. But it's something for us to be aware of when we might lose the story of a people in order to tell one person's story. I think it's possible to be sensitive and to do both. Like many things, including extractive capitalism and the rise of fascism, it's not inevitable that we offer preference to the one over the many. I'll tell this story in a new way next time. And it's my hope that by sharing it, even in a way that feels perhaps incomplete at this moment, it's an invitation to you to think about the way that you tell, read, and consume stories. Who are you honoring? Who are you casting in shadow? Who have you neglected? Because that's just the way it's always been. I'm going to leave it there. I hope that this story of Teltu has offered something to you, whether it's about the way that you engage with work and with service, whether it's the way that you're being called to rest and practice patience, whether there's something to be said about the way that you have accidentally or otherwise othered people, forgotten that they have a worthy narrative too, and decided there's just one way to tell a story. Because that is what I'm learning in Knotwork over and over again. We're well into the hundreds of episodes. Repeats are going to happen. And whether that is bringing you something from our best of archive, or it's inviting new storytellers to come with different takes on tales we've already shared in the last few years, that is a key aspect of mythworking. It's the revisiting, the retelling, the reimagining, to allow the work itself to keep reworking us. It just occurs to me that we are still in the midst of a Mercury retrograde. And while I was traveling during it and generally speaking decided to tune out all astrology and decide that it didn't apply to me, I have had so many friends and colleagues and clients call this one out. So I want to remind you, if you find that communication seems difficult and you're never making that connecting flight when you need to, keep in mind that this time of retrograde, when Mercury, the planet that's so connected to communication, seems to be making everything in your life go backwards, it's also a powerful time to review, to revise, to go back, to look for what's good in what's been there in the past, and to look to what wants to be revisited and wants to remake us in some small way. I hope that your first harvest of Lunasa is full of fertile possibility. I hope you'll consider joining us in the Writer's Knot when we get started together in early September and really take on that energy of autumn and, of course, that energy of back to school for those of us in the Northern Hemisphere. There's something to be said for allowing that particular rhythm so many of us have known since childhood and allowing it to continue to work on us as adults. To begin again together, to write together and imagine together. Blessings, Lunasa blessings to all. Thank you for tuning in to Knotwork Myth and Storytelling. Please subscribe and review the show on your favorite podcast platform, and do share this episode with other lovers of mythology and story. By the way, everyone is a lover of mythology and story, even if they've forgotten. Creating this show is a labor of love, and your support will help me continue to craft and share stories throughout this season and beyond. Please consider becoming a paid subscriber to my newsletter, Myth is Medicine, over on Substack, where you'll find new writing and conversations each week. You can find out more about my writing, my book, our online writing communities, as well as how to work with me as a writing coach at marisagowdy.com. Gratefully, I live, write, work, and record this podcast on the ancestral lands of the Munsee Lenape tribe, whose name means original people. Music on this show is performed by Beth Sweeney and Billy Hardy.